Hi everyone, welcome to the third episode of the Collective Cast, our Housefold podcast about all things collective redress. We've got a lot to cover in this episode, stemming from two hearings that took place last week. The first is the CPO hearings, the certification hearings in the two collective claims brought following the trucks cartel. The second is the Supreme Court hearing in Lloyd and Google, which is the seminal case relating to losses stemming from breaches of data protection law, and of course very important for the purposes of the use of the opt-out mechanism in CPR 19.6. So to discuss all of that, I'm joined by Anthony Mason, Scott Campbell, Nicola Boyle and Tim Brown. And we're going to start with the second case first, Lloyd and Google. So Tim, over to you to tell us a little bit about that case.
Thanks, Lucy. Just to briefly summarise the facts of this case. So this is a claim for damages on behalf of approximately 4 million iPhone users, and they were a victim of a mass breach of data protection laws by Google. Richard Lloyd, the claimant, does not allege financial loss or distress, but the compensation be awarded for the infringement of data protection rights and loss of control of personal data. So the breach centered on the Safari workaround, and this allowed Google to evade iPhone privacy settings, set the what's called a double click add cookie on each device without the user's knowledge or consent, and then it tracked the user's internet usage to create browser generated information or BGI. So this information included information relating to internet surfing, of course, but also the habits and the location of the surfer. It also allowed Google to deduce information about their interests, race or ethnicity, social class, political or religious views, age, health, gender, sexuality, and financial position, this is alleged. And the BGI was obviously sold to advertisers. So those are the main facts of the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so and how did this case end up in the Supreme Court?
So the case ended up in the Supreme Court because at first instance, the High Court declined to allow service out of proceedings. And the case is brought as a representative action under 19.6 of the CPR. At the Court of Appeal level, the High Court decision was overturned and the case was deemed to be fit to be brought under 19.6. The case was deemed to be suitable to be brought under 19.6 and then to be reassessed by the High Court exercising its discretion. There are two main issues under the appeal to the Supreme Court. The first is whether damages are available for loss of control. And the second issue is whether the claim can proceed as a representative action under CPR 19.6, and in particular, the interpretation of the same interest requirement. So for the first issue, loss of control, the Supreme Court is grappling with this fundamental question of whether loss of control is a harm which may be compensated in damages. Control over data, the claimants say, is a fundamental right, to the right to privacy and autonomy over data, and this is separate from an economic value. And having control over personal data is not an abstract concept, but it's what citizens want and expect from data protection rules. If people don't have confidence that the law provides a proper protection, there's a risk of wider harm to society also. So for example, people may be less willing to participate in various initiatives, public health initiatives most recently is an example, if they don't have confidence in how their data is being handled. So the arguments around this were whether loss of control is itself synonymous with the breach, or whether it's a separate harm. And the claimants were able to point to examples of technical infringements of the Data Protection Act, which did not result in loss of control in order to distinguish it from that synonymous point. So it's a fundamental issue, and it'll be very interesting to see how the Supreme Court land on that, of course. And then the second main issue is 19.6 procedure itself. And this representative action procedure is an opt-out mechanism which allows a claim to be brought by one individual on behalf of a large group of individuals in this case. And in order to do so, all of the members of the class have to have the same interest in the claim. So the Supreme Court were looking at the various aspects of the claim and to ascertain whether this same interest requirement was met at all relevant stages. And in order to satisfy the same interest requirement as to damages, the claimant is asserting that each member of the class has suffered a lowest common denominator amount of damages. And so all the represented members of the class are victims of the same alleged wrong, and they've all sustained the same loss, namely loss of control over their BGI. So the claim does not rely on any facts affecting any individuals in the class specifically, for example, individual distress or monetary loss. And this reduces the damages to what may be described as lowest common denominator damages. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court were interested in how this could affect individual claimants and whether potentially this approach would stop individual claimants from bringing larger claims. And the claimants had several answers to this. They say that the representative action procedure is not a rigid rule, but a flexible procedural rule of convenience. It can be used to determine issues impacting large numbers of consumers. Fundamentally, representative actions promote access to justice and enable individuals to hold large corporations to account. And without the mechanism, it's not a viable there is no viable way of bringing such claims. And also, as a protection, it's an opt-out claim, as I mentioned earlier, meaning that individuals do not have to participate in the claim, and the court's case management powers can be used to enable members to opt out. So, for example, if you had a claim for distress or for monetary loss, you could opt out of the claim. And in addition, a claim for damages per se wasn't a bar to proceedings under 19.6. So there are lots of obviously very key and fundamental issues to address in this appeal, which will be very interesting, obviously, to see how it comes out.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tim. That was that's all very good to understand. I mean, it's fair to say there's a lot riding on it, right?
Yes, that's right. This claim obviously itself is an innovative use of the 19.6 points procedure, as the claimants freely admit, and potentially it could provide a means of bringing claims for other types of breaches of Data Protection Act, which have similarly wide ranging repercussions for large groups of individuals. Mm-hmm.
And the broader issue here, Lucy, is going to be if this fails, there is going to be effectively a very large lacuna in our justice system, because the reality, if you can't bring these data breach cases and other consumer cases by way of an opt-out procedure, then the reality is there is no way to bring them. If you look at that in the data breach field, you may say, well, that's not such an evil when there's been inadvertent. Data breach and people can't see, but a lot of these cases are around advertent data breach, where people have deliberately broken the rules and misuse consumer data. And if there's no action, civil action can be brought for those wrongs, then we have a very huge lacuna in our system, and it's going to mean that absent statutory intervention, consumers going to be left without remedies. And I do wonder where that, on a philosophical level, where does that leave our justice system when wrongs cannot be remedied before the courts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, all eyes on the Supreme Court then for that judgment. Presumably, Tim, it's coming, we think, in, I don't know, a few months.
It's always difficult to predict when a judgment's going to come down. But yes, let's hope so. It's going to come down relatively soon.
Yeah.
Okay. The Supremes will keep us hanging on, Lucy.
Indeed. Right. Thanks very much, Tim. So now to the truck CPO hearings, which were also last week. I think there are two main areas that we're hoping to cover. At the first, I think that arguably the most obvious, you've got two class representatives here, both vying, seemingly, to represent the class and be certified. Scott, do you want to tell us a little bit about those two claims?
Yes, well, these claims come against the background of a huge amount of activity in the CAT already, where individual claimants have brought claims to try and recover losses arising from the trucks cartel, which was a long-running cartel from 1997 to 2011. And it's attracted, as I say, a number of claimants, many of whom we represent on an individual basis. But two collective claims have been brought, the first of which by the Road Haulage Association, which is effectively an industry association, and it's constituted on an opt-in basis. So its members are in a position to sign up to that action proactively, whereas the other competing claim, UKTC, UK Trucks Claims, was constructed for this purpose. It's a special purpose vehicle, and it's constituted on an opt-out basis, so a class-wide basis. But alternatively, if that doesn't work, then it's happy to operate on an opt-in basis, although indications to date show that it's not had many people signing up and showing interest. Contrast that with RHA, which has got many thousands of members which have signed up, many of whom are SMEs. Mm-hmm. And so really, this is a dispute between not only the defendants and those putative claimants, but also it's a competition between the two sets of collective applications to see who can go ahead from this point. Hitherto, there had been speculation that it might be possible for both of these CPOs to be certified and go forward in tandem. And the one way I looked at that is possibly that the RHA would have been certified in an opt-in basis, whereas UKTC may have been certified on an opt-out basis and mop up the rest of the market. And coming back to the claimants that we represent and others represent, which have already started claims, well, they've already opted out effectively. So you've got quite a complex web of actions. From what I've seen of the transcripts or the reports of the applications, Mr. Justice Roth has indicated that he is only minded to certify one of these actions. So I think we're all eyes and ears as to which one that is. We await the judgment on that after the three-day hearing last week.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the main battlegrounds then is whether or not the class should be an opt-in class or an opt-out class. And I think, Nicola, the hearing saw arguments as between both representatives as to whether opt-out or opt-in would be most suitable.
That's right, Lucy, and it's the first test we've really seen on this question about where the CAT is going to set the threshold. And it's fair to say the guide says that where practicable, you should use an opt-in mechanism. And I think it's the first true test, especially as Scott says, where you've got a very large number of SMEs as to where that threshold is going to be set. It's worth sort of thinking perhaps what the difference is between the two. In an opt-in action, each of those thousands of SMEs that, as Scott says, have indicated interest would actually have to sign up to join the claim to the funding and the engagement documents. And one of the points that came out of the different methodologies was that the claim may also seek data from claimants to help effectively work out individual assessments of loss for the total group of claimants. By contrast, of course, in an opt-out, all those SMEs would be deemed part of the class And it would be run with an aggregate calculation of damage. And so I think one of the questions is, where does the CAT set the threshold? And it did, in fact, ask the UKTC that's seeking the opt-out why it wasn't practical in their mind to run it as an opt-in. So I think it's going to be quite key in terms of claims to come where that boundary is set.
Yeah, okay. And so there are some of the arguments that the claimants were making about their own claims and then vis-a-vis each other's claim. I guess my other question is, what were the defendants saying? What were the main arguments the defendants were making?
It's interesting, Lucy, first of all, of course, that the defendants, to some extent, in a carriage dispute, can allow the claimants to compete against each other. But as you say, they also put forward their own arguments. And one of them, in fact, coming from Daimler, related to the concept of having uninjured claimants potentially in the class. And this was directed to the UKTC's proposed opt-out regime. And it was really focusing in on a US concept that features very heavily in their class action regime, where they're saying there may, you know, within the class, you've got to be able to identify the presence of claimants that are uninjured by the cartel. And so it was accepted that doesn't necessarily stop it being certified, but that you have to have a methodology so that later on you can exclude them from the aggregate damages award.
Yeah. Okay. And I understood there was also an argument as well around the inclusion of both used and new trucks in the class.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, Lucy. So the defendants are arguing that, in fact, there was pass on. So when you own a truck and you sell it on in the market, there's effectively a pass on of your loss, and therefore there's a conflict in position between new truck owners and used truck owners, which means that a claimant law firm cannot act for both, or minimally has to at least have subclasses to deal with that issue. So I think it's been suggested by the RHA that they deal with that by way of six subclasses. I think the UKTC have simply taken the used trucks out of their claim in order to deal with that issue. But from a defendant perspective, what it obviously adds is levels of complexity, confusion, complication that add time and costs, which defendants always love.
Yeah, and I suppose a related part of that is the definition of what is a used truck, what is a used truck purchase. So for instance, if you're a business that bought another business which had previously owned trucks and it becomes part of your corporate group, is that a used truck? And so Anthony, you're quite right that throws oil on the water and makes it a much more complex structure.
Yeah, okay. And I understand also potentially some suggested complexity around how the trucks were actually purchased, whether or not this could rightly be assumed to be a common issue amongst class members.
Yeah, I suppose buying a truck is quite a major purchase. It's a big piece of equipment, and you can go about it in different ways. You can purchase it directly, or you can go to a truck dealer. Some of those truck dealers are captives of the manufacturers, others are independent. Some people choose to lease trucks, and you can lease trucks on a variety of different bases. And you can lease trucks from third parties who specialize in the business of buying and then sweating trucks as assets for people who want to use them but don't want to own or directly lease trucks. So you get it into multiple categories and different ways that people pay for trucks.
Lisa, I'm sure over time, just to pick up on a couple of the things that Nicola talked about that I think are interesting. The first is this idea that, you know, when you've got conflicting claims, you do get into the guts of the economics in a way that obviously in Merrick's wasn't contemplated. Merrick said, well, let's effectively skate over the merits of the claim, certify it, and then get into the action. When you get into a carriage fight, you get dragged back into that, looking at the merits, which seems to me slightly ironic. And the second thing is this difference between opt-in and opt-out is the value of the economics for claimants, because if you're constructing an opt-in claim, you're constructing a claim where each claimant is agreeing to give away typically 25 to 30% of the value of their claim, whereas an opt-out claim, of course, means there'll be a residue of claim value, which means that effectively 100% of the value can pass to claimants. And I'm never sure, you know, whether that has clocked by the CAT in terms of looking at the difference in opt-in and opt-out, actually what that value means to claimants, and at the end of the day, how many pennies they're going to get in their pockets.
And that's an interesting point, I think, Anthony, because as you say, the class rep that wants to act in the best interest of the class has to suggest that an opt-in is somehow going to benefit the class more, notwithstanding that they're going to have that deduction from their damages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, it'll certainly be interesting to see where the tribunal come out on all of these issues. You know, the points that the defendants have been raising, uninjured claimants, for example, and also on the opt-in, opt-out question. And they will only certify one, as they've said. So, yeah, certainly interesting to see. And I think, though this is the third CPO hearing, and we're awaiting three judgments.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we've got BT coming up, and then obviously FX after that. And one starts to wonder whether the CAT is going to roll this into a sort of huge judgment that covers all of them at the end of the day. We'll see.
Yeah.
I suppose, Lucy, there is a possibility that neither of these actions get certified for one reason or another. And then there's a prospect of appeals on the back of those. And depending on the way the appeals go, and if they go to the Supreme Court, whether they come back to the CAT for another go at certification. So it could be a long time.
Yeah. And many more collective casts. We watch them through. All right. Thanks very much, all.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.